Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the seminar and audio conference on key issues and legal considerations for IT companies USA. This event is being organized by NASSCOM and Nishit Desai Associates in collaboration with Keckler Brown. The speakers are Nishit Desai, Founder and Managing Director, Nishit Desai Associates, Vinita Bhari Mehra, Global Business Attorney, Keckler Brown, Ralph Bretzeler, Global Business Attorney, Keckler Brown, Rajesh Simon, Head International Tax, Nishit Desai Associates, Rakhi Jindal, Co-Head, Data Protection and Privacy Practice, Nishit Desai Associates. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's presentation. Should you need assistance during this conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on the App Store for iOS device, Play Store for Androids, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. With this, I would now like to hand the session over to NASSCOM. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thank you. Good evening once again. I'm Nawzar Dalal, CEO for Enex Financials Limited. We are a Tata enterprise in the enterprise solution space. But more importantly, I'm here on behalf of NASSCOM. I'm a member of the Regional Council for the Western Zone for NASSCOM, and I'm happy to actually fill in for two of NASSCOM Western India stalwarts, who are also good friends now, that's Rajiv Vaishnav and Chetan Saman. Unfortunately, because of some other commitments, they could not be here. So they handed over to me the sort of pleasant task of kicking off this evening session. The lady on the conference call made my life a little easier by introducing all the esteemed speakers for the evening, but while the introduction doesn't, let me also take this opportunity to thank Nishit Desai and Associates and Desai sir personally, as also Vinita, Ralph, Rajesh, and Rakhi for, you know, the time they've spent or will spend in terms of taking us through a very important aspect of how do we sort of make it simple for doing business in the U.S. Yeah. It sort of also resonates. Our Prime Minister has been saying that let's make doing business in India simple. Hopefully by the end of this session, we will all go back feeling that doing business in the U.S. also is simple, provided sort of we keep all the legal considerations and the data privacy regulations in mind. Yeah. So I think without further ado, let me sort of hand over to Mr. Nishit Desai, who really needs no introduction, a luminary in his field. Thank you, sir, once again for organizing this in association with NASSCOM. And thank you for all those who have taken the effort to come down to this place in Bandra, as also those who are on the call listening. Thank you once again.
Thank you so much, Nawzar, Ralph, Vinita, and my colleagues, Rajesh and Rakhi. This is one of the most exciting subjects of what you call globalization. My affair with globalization started sometime in 1977. I specialized in globalization at a time when India was localizing. Coca-Cola was thrown out in 1977. IBM was thrown out in 1977. And I did my master's in international comparative law, corporate law, and special tax and stuff like that. And there was no ticker for my work. And but as it happened, just about the same time, one company came up, okay, and I helped them set up first New York office. That was TCS, by the way. Mr. F.C. Coley was the head, and Mr. Palkivella was also, I think, the chairman. And that was my first exposure to real-life globalizing Indian company. And So, you know, this subject I hold very much to my heart. And just as a matter of, you know, a little further take, I personally do not believe in the theory of state. Nation is different from state. In the next 30 to 50 years, you will see more and more disappearance of state. Everything will become global. Everything will become geography agnostic. And therefore, we all have to be prepared in one way or the other. So globalization, to me, is more a matter of mindset than what you call internationalization or multinationalization is a matter of, you know, physical offices elsewhere and stuff like that. So we need to understand that this is going to happen. And, you know, there will be more and more search for new markets, new technologies, natural resources, market diversification, global finance, and, you know, a number of different things that would be happening across. More and more business would be, of course, on the e-commerce, whether it's B2B or B2C, or P2P, people-to-people, peer-to-people, like bitcoins. I expect that to happen in next 5 to 7 years. It will be most disruptive technology. It's very interesting technology, no doubt about it. And once Bitcoin comes, how will the currency function? We have already specialized in that subject. So we need to be cognizant as to what are the new things that are going to come up. And once again, we believe that every new technology, every new financial instrument, every new business model brings along with it, you know, legal, tax, business strategic issues. Look at Wi-Fi, WiMAX, quantum computing, e-commerce, fuel cells, nanotechnology, stem cells, medical devices, whether it's a drug or a device or stuff like that. Now, on a global basis, we don't have even today what is called world patent regime. We are still divided by geographies. You know, some point in time, we'll have to think. Now, some of these are issues will need to be addressed. I'm not going to talk too long. Two things are happening. One, you have to look at your current national laws, and you also have to look at the international law, the foreign laws or tax or businesses or culture and stuff like that. But wading your way through all this complexity, I think one thing is happening, that more and more laws are also getting somewhat harmonized today. So U.S. has become the largest exporter today of laws, regulations, and policies. Possibly manufacturing is lost to China. At one point of time, we looked to England for all the education. Now it's all happening, and research is happening in the U.S. I see new age issues are coming up from there. So it will be very important to understand this dynamics, and how things change on a daily basis is also very critical. So, and as I see, the cycles are also getting shorter and shorter. In 1930s, the Great Depression went on for about 10, 15 years or whatever it is. Then the cycle reduced to 10 years, and then to 7 years, and then to 3 years. Now it is every 2, 3 years cycles change, you know, about 1,000 days, I would say. So it is very important that, you know, we know how business practices happen. Particularly now, I would just go to the U.S. and they will talk a lot more about U.S. U.S. in one sentence, I would say, you call it United States of America. It's most un-United States of America. Okay. And, you know, so it is very important to know at a broader level the U.S. and at a state level the U.S. I think I'm sure you're going to deal with all those things. And structuring is also becoming very important. So far, and I'll finish with that. So we all talk about structuring investment or IP. So investment structuring is very different from IP structuring, where to hold IP, where to, you know, house your intangible, unlike where to hold investment from. Those are two different kind of things. But when we talk about structuring, more important now is architectural. There's a slight difference between structuring and architectural work. In architecture, it's more aesthetic, it is more conceptual, it's more philosophical, you know. Why? Because just take a look at tax, for example. So far, if you complied with a law, tax law, that was good enough. Because you see, this is fully compliant with law. Now what's happening? Apple, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, okay, Starbucks, they all complied with law. But the public woke up in England and, you know, made a noise out of that. Everything was legal. There was nothing illegal about it. Okay? So you not only have to plan and structure, but also communicate with the public at large. The stakeholders are now very looking at the whole thing very differently. Simply because you complied legally, it doesn't mean that you did the right thing. So Starbucks, even though they didn't have to pay tax in the UK, they said, okay, we'll pay some kind of a moral tax. Okay? Otherwise, everything was fine. Irish double sandwich was very common going on. Apple, you know better than I know. Everything was perfectly okay. But still, you need to think broader issues, because in India also now we got GAR coming up. GAR is so much perception driven than just, you know, in terms of a hard black and white kind of a line, you know. So, you know, these are the situations really we need to deal with. And and so, you know, at a philosophical level, to what you call the, you know, to your structuring level, to architectural level, at all levels, you take a holistic view. Then you mitigate the risk in terms of your reputation, in terms of your legal handling and stuff like that. And a role of a law firm, more and more going to be to provide higher value services. Compliance would be done more and more in-house, because that is more cost efficient, much faster, better, in some ways cheaper as well. So we will move on to doing higher value stuff, and more important role than even legal, lawyers' role will evolve into more ethical advisors, or kind of, you know, those kind of where judgmental issues come up on the board. So I'll stop at this point in time, and, you know, Rajesh, you're going to take off now?
Yeah, I think I'm
okay.
Going to.
Okay, Rajesh is my brain count. I am a head count in the organization. So he will talk about structuring and other kind of things. Thank you.
Thanks, Rajesh, for the introduction. I think there are a couple of key points that you sort of raised today, which I think is a good starting point for me, where you're talking about that there are three multiple different issues that are there. One is that even when you're talking about structuring, the fact that how you structure your companies is slightly different from how you probably structure for IP. Similarly, the other key thing which was really the question being that the way the world is sort of moving towards is that having a nice structure may not necessarily work. I think most countries, you have the OECD, which is coming up with a base erosion and profit shifting project, which people think is going to have a substantial effect over a period of time on the way companies are doing business. So you are moving towards increasingly what I would look at as a substance-driven sort of approach, even when people are looking at acquisitions or outbound or inbound structuring, whichever way you look at it. So when we start looking at it, and again, I'm going to pick up on different strands of topic, because the moment you start looking at, let's say, your overseas investment, there are, to my mind, three different aspects that you need to sort of keep in mind. The first is the laws relating to the country from where you are investing. So if you're looking at an Indian company which is investing abroad, let's say, into the US, the first critical factor is what really are the regulatory framework in India as far as outbound investments are concerned, and what is the kind of restrictions which are sort of imposed. That's the first aspect that you always need to keep in mind. The second aspect is the laws relating to the host country, which in this case would be, let's say, US, since that's what we are talking about today, in terms of some of the conditions and restrictions which are there around the US. The U.S. regulatory framework. And the third aspect, which sort of always floats around, is do I look at direct investing? Do I set up a holding company for investment? In which case, you are also looking at laws of a third jurisdiction that's also coming into play. So when you're looking at any sort of structuring or any sort of investment outside of India, you have to take into account what are the different laws which sort of work in each of the jurisdictions. Different jurisdictions can sometimes be an enabling factor. For example, if you're setting up an intermediate holding company, that may be for just holding the equity share. You may be looking at IP structuring in a completely different manner, where there are a number of incentives are provided in certain countries, both from a patent protection or a IP protection, as well as potentially from a tax perspective. So there are different strands which sort of go into sort of when you're looking at any kind of structure. Stepping back for a minute, there are times when even when you're looking at, let's say, doing business with the US, there is a critical distinction that is there between doing business with the country and doing business in a country. If you're doing business with a country, you don't necessarily need to have a physical presence or anything in the country. You do have, at least in the IT space, there are a number of companies which do business with the US but not necessarily in the US. So that kind of distinction is probably the starting point when you're looking at expanding into any country, because the question that always arises, do I really need to actually have an office or a company set up in that particular jurisdiction? And is it going to be a long-term situation? Is it going to be a short-term project office sort of thing before you actually make that decision? And that sometimes is actually a critical factor, because what you need to keep in mind is that in most cases, the country with which you're doing business with is probably going to be a high-tax jurisdiction. So I think the U.S. is a nice example of it, because if you're actually setting up and doing business in the U.S., you're looking at a federal tax, you're looking at a state-level tax, and probably sometimes at a city-level tax also. So you are dealing with a country where there is a high-tax jurisdiction. So the question always is, okay, do I need to necessarily set up a presence in the U.S. as far as investment is concerned? Once you take that call saying that, yes, it does make business or commercial sense for me to make that particular investment, that's when all the different restrictions sort of come into play. I'm broadly setting out in terms of what really are the things that you keep in mind as far as India and possibly the intermediate jurisdictions are concerned. I'm going to leave it to Vinita and Raj to sort of talk about some of the U.S.-related issues. Primarily, when you look at the Indian regulation, there are probably, to my mind, two or three aspects that are relevant. The first is the exchange control restriction. Because unlike in most countries, India, you have the exchange control restrictions, which today provide that any investment abroad has to be by way of a joint venture or a wholly owned subsidiary abroad. Portfolio investments outside of India is permitted only under restricted circumstances. So that's always an issue that is there, saying, because, for example, a lot of companies today in the IT sector are looking towards setting up something like an incubation fund. So the question always arises that, is that something that is permitted under the automatic route or not? So that's something, there is always some degree of sensitivity around exchange control regulations. Today, an Indian entity can invest up to 4 times its net worth abroad. So anything beyond that, you need a regulatory approval. Until there's been some degree of back and forth by the Reserve Bank of India, they had reduced the limits a couple of years back to 1 times the net worth, but they've again increased it back to 4 times net worth. So as far as the quantum of investment is concerned, there are restrictions that are there. Similarly, there are restrictions around things like issuance of ESOP, because that's something very common in this industry, where you are looking towards potentially issuing ESOP even to, if you're setting up a subsidiary, let's say in US, and hiring key personnel, you want to issue ESOP. So the questions always arise around, how do I sort of set up something as far as they are concerned. Third aspect that sort of comes into play is around the Companies Act, in terms of, for example, the number of layers of investment companies that you can set up prior to setting up of an operating company. Similarly, if you're doing an acquisition and doing a share swap, which again is something that is pretty common, there are restrictions that are there under the Companies Act, and even if you're a listed company, you have to. There are SEBI guidelines also that you sort of need. And I think the last one, which has sort of become critical, at least in the last few years, is also the antitrust and the merger control regulation, which is the Competition Act, which sort of comes into play as far as most large acquisitions are concerned, and something that we have seen quite frequently in the last couple of years, especially because you do have a large bunch of Indian IT companies who have a lot of cash in their books, which can be used for acquisitions. So merger controls also sort of have a role to play. As I said, the second part of it was really the laws relating to U.S., where you have to keep into account both the federal as well as the state-level laws, and also similarly on the antitrust regulations in the U.S. And in certain particular spheres, there are certain regulatory or national security issues which are actually also relevant. We, in fact, recently had a client who had a substantial operations in the U.S., but unfortunately also had operations in companies with which U.S. has barred operations with, something like Syria or Iran. So those are softer aspects which also come into place when you're looking at investing in particular countries, saying that, well, U.S. may not necessarily have certain bars on you, on any Indian company or Indian company having operations in the U.S., having operations in some of these blacklisted countries. So those are also issues that sort of come into play the moment you're looking at doing business abroad. The other aspect which I was talking about is really as far as the structural issue. When you're looking at saying that, do I invest directly in the U.S.? Do I set up a holding company for really investment into U.S.? If I'm looking at a acquisition sort of scenario, do I get in debt onto the books? At which level do I get debt in? Because do I get debt onto the Indian books and then use it for acquisition? Do I get debt onto potentially a holding company and then use that for the acquisition? So all of those become critical factors, and it sort of goes into what I call the ETR, the effective tax rate. Because depending on where you get debt in the books, for example, your deductibility will also sort of change, and Indian laws are not really, as in you have your own set of restrictions, even as far as deduction is concerned. And the critical aspect really as far as choices are concerned is really repatriation of funds. And that sort of becomes important because that's really what is your strategy. Are you looking at organic sort of growth where there's not really going to be any sort of cash repatriation? But are you looking at using the cash in the U.S. for further acquisitions, which again, there can be challenges around that. And we have seen structures where Indian companies have acquired U.S. companies. There's cash in the U.S. books, which has been used for further investment abroad. And then you're sort of stuck in a situation because when you look at how do I get the money back into India, I'm looking at layers and layers of tax before the money actually comes into India. We've actually seen situations where we've had an Indian company which held a U.S. company, which again held an Indian company back. And the company was really struggling with how do I repatriate the cash, because I do want the cash back into the main parent company in India, but how do I get it back? Because when you sort of did the math, you realize that more than 60% was going towards taxes. So what you could really repatriate was only 40%. So that's where it becomes a critical when you're looking at saying, how do I really go about it at the time of setting up of operations itself. The other question that is also there is that even when you're looking at, well, do I put in equity, do I put in debt, you also, in a lot of jurisdictions, you also have the ability to put in what you would call as hybrid instruments, where they're treated as debt for some purposes and they're treated as equity for some purposes. So all of those sort of become critical factors when you're sort of looking at the actual investment. The third thing which I said was what is critical is as far as repatriation. I think right up front you do need to decide as to what is the form of repatriation that is happening. Are you looking at dividend income? If I'm doing a debt push down sort of structure, you can get in interest flow through also coming in. And similarly, a lot of cases you have managerial services where you sort of get either fees for managerial services or fees for administrative services. And in the context of royalty, especially royalty or fees for technical services. So that again becomes critical because today if everything is happening from India and US directly and you don't have, let's say you don't have anything else in the structure, you're either going to be taxed in the US at whatever 35 to 45%, or you're going to be taxed in India the same 30-odd%. So that's where it gets critical as to how do I really structure. Do we have the ability to potentially use a holding company which can hold IP and license it out to all the other entities in the group without necessarily having the IP held either in the US company or in the Indian company? And similarly, whether it is possible for me to really have the intermediate company sort of push down debt into the US. So that sort of becomes critical. So I know I'm sort of running out of time. So what I'm going to do is look at least the way at least some of the deals have been structured on the acquisition space. I sort of picked out an example, not necessarily in the IT space, but something on the Apollo Cooper deal, which was in the manufacturing or the tire space. But it's very interesting because pretty much all the issues that we spoke about or I've been talking about has sort of been captured in this deal, because you effectively had an Indian company which is looking at acquiring US target entity. And if you look at the way that they really structured the deal, what they did was that in the first place, I think the deal value was around $2.5 billion. The deal did break off, but the deal value was around $2.5 billion. So the first thing was that, okay, what do I do? In the books of Apollo India, I raise a $450 million debt, which in this instance was structured as an ECB, external commercial borrowing, where you take a dollar-denominated loan, which the ECB norms today permit you to actually use that for acquisition or investment abroad. So you took a dollar-denominated loan in the books of the Indian company so that you have the ability to use that as a deduction in the Indian books against the profits of the Indian company. You push that down to Mauritius in this particular instance, which was really a global holding company as far as they were concerned, which went out into the Dutch Holdco, which was an operating company, by the way. It was a holding operating company because it also had various other operations that were there. And then you had the U.S. acquisition, where you had the Dutch Holdco set up a Delaware entity, which then effectively merged into the target company, which is really the common way of doing an acquisition in the U.S., where you effectively also ensure that there was debt in the books of the target because it was effectively a leveraged buyout. So in this case, what they really did was that the $2.5 billion acquisition price was completely structured through pure debt. But what they did was that they ensured that they could have some of the debt in India, which could reduce the Indian company's sort of profit, and at the same time put the remaining debt into the U.S. company, which could again go down as a deduction in the U.S. So then in the two high-tax jurisdictions, they managed to get a deduction. While at the same time, since the profits were going to be upstream to the Dutch Co., which should have been used for investment in some of the other places that they're contemplating about. So that sort of gives you a flavor, really, in terms of the way that when you're looking at sort of structuring abroad, some of the factors that you sort of need to keep in mind, at least from an Indian perspective when you're looking abroad. And again, since I know we are short of time, so what I'll do is I'll probably leave it up to Vinita to sort of look at some of the U.S. aspects in terms of the key considerations once somebody is looking at the U.S. For investment.
Thank you,
Vinita.
So I actually have a total of close to 40 slides, but because we have less time, we're just going to do a very high-level overview of key issues if you're looking at doing business in the USA. My role here today is to just give you a basic outline of the legal landscape in the U.S. You know, how many of you all are already doing business in the U.S., in the group? Okay, so we have a few. And then how many of you all want to do business in the U.S.? I guess that's why you're sitting here, right? You know? So maybe the rest of them, you know. So obviously, U.S. is definitely open for business. We see that happening with Obama's visit to India, We see that by happening the Prime Minister Modi's visit to New York. You know, timing of in terms of investments and timing in terms of joint collaboration couldn't have been more ripe than it is as of today. And that also is partly because both governments are making an effort to come up with joint policies to make the ease of doing business in the U.S. for Indian companies to be much easier, and vice versa, having companies who are doing business in India much easier. So in terms of timing of investment and timing of market reality, couldn't have been much more right than before. We are also seeing a lot of stabilization of valuations of U.S. companies. As Nishit Bhai had said that, you know, U.S. did go through a recession phase in the last 3 years. So the valuations were sort of, you know, at low, but it still really didn't show the net worth of the company. And again, the whole concept of net worth in U.S. works very differently from the way the net worth is here in India. So in terms of valuations of and pricing of companies, if you're looking at an acquisitions and things like that, has kind of, I would say, bottomed out. And they have come to a balanced way of coming up with the right value for the company in terms of acquisition. But one of the biggest statistics I want to bring to your attention is India is actually the 8th fastest growing source of FDI in the U.S. And actually, when we talk about foreign direct investment, we get very kind of narrow focus on just in terms of, like we said, acquisition, joint ventures, you know, greenfield operations, but nobody looks at another aspect of India-U.S. collaboration, which is actually export. So India is actually emerging to be the 8th largest export market. And when we talk about export, we're not only talking about goods, we're also talking about services. So for IT companies such as yours, you know, what you're really doing in terms of your business is you're exporting services to the U.S. And it's actually become the 8th largest country in terms of export of both goods and services. The state of Ohio that we come from, where our law firm is based and most of the business we do out of, India is actually the 10th largest country just for the state of Ohio in terms of export of goods and services. So we see a lot happening in terms of export too, in addition to just basic foreign direct investments that are coming into the U.S., you know. I look at, you know, business done between Indian IT companies and U.S. in two ways. One is option one, which is contractual arrangements, which actually Roger very nicely pointed out is doing business with USA. And the way you will do business with USA would be through contractual arrangements that you have currently, be it with customer, service providers, a wide variety of licensing of technologies, you know, that's doing business with USA. The second option you would look at US would be a market entry strategy, which Roger very rightly pointed out, doing business in USA. You know, so let's spend some time on what are some of the key legal issues you will face in a contractual formation. In a contractual formation, if you get a contract from a customer, service provider, you know, licensor technology, you have to keep in mind one clause that will be in that agreement will be compliance with what we call the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act, which is called FCPA. What the FCPA is actually, it was enacted in 1977, and it actually requires that a U.S. person should not get into any bribery situations, obviously within the U.S. as well as in foreign jurisdictions. However, what happened with the FCPA was in 1998, there were certain amendments that came onto the FCPA which made the enforceability of the FCPA beyond extraterritorial jurisdiction extraterritorial jurisdiction, but also said that if you have agents, distributors, service providers in foreign countries, and you are doing a transaction with them, you have to make sure that they also comply with FCPA. So what has happened in the U.S. legal industries and contract formation is as a safe harbor rule, you know, any contract that you will work with will have an FCPA compliance clause. And at least we've seen, and you can also check with Nisha Data and Associates, 8 out of 10 times that's non-negotiable. At least as a U.S. Advisor, if I am working with a U.S. company and an Indian company says, and we hear this all a lot of time, Gauri and I have worked on a couple of matters where we hear, we are not a U.S. company. Why the hell should we comply with FCPA? Yeah, we have Prevention of Corruption Act here. You won't put that into the contract. But I can tell you, at least 8 out of 10 times, that's a non-negotiable clause by a U.S. company or by the U.S. legal advisor. So mentally, you have to be prepared that in any agreements that you get into in the U.S., you would have to deal with this compliance clause. Now, there are two ways of doing that. One is you can blindly sign that contract and say, yeah, we comply with FCPA. But if you do nothing about it, you know, and there would be some FCPA anti-violation, then in addition to the U.S. companies, and if if the lawyers are smart, they have an indemnification clause. They can come after you for not complying with FCPA. So what we advise to our Indian clients or any foreign company who is doing business with a U.S. company is, if you have decided to sign off on a clause which has an FCPA obligation on it, then internally spend the time to put an FCPA compliance program in place. Because then you're also making your own safe harbor compliance provisions so that if there is any violation by default or, you know, inadvertently, you have also have enough evidence to show that you put a compliance program in place. And, you know, law firms like, you know, Nishit Desai and other firms can help you to put that in place. So we always say, don't blindly just sign the agreement. Oh, yeah, my U.S. customer is telling me, what's the big deal? I'll sign it off. There's also going to be an enforceability and obligation there. So think of putting compliance programs in place if you have signed off on a clause like this. And then most importantly, if you're going to use third-party service providers or agents or subcontractors for your agreement, the buck doesn't just stop at you. You want to make sure your third-party service providers, your agents, also comply with this clause. So you should have code of conduct or policies which would then also apply to your third-party service providers or your subcontractors who are working on that agreement or that project, you know. Another aspect you will see in contractual arrangements in the U.S. is you get a lot of restrictive covenants that are put into the agreement. Restrictive covenants are nothing but they are basically your non-competition, your non-solicitation, your non-disclosure, you know. However, in U.S., and Rajesh hinted to that, a lot of the laws are at federal level and at state level. So the restrictive covenants is one good example where you have to do compliance under a federal law level as well as a state law level. A good example is the state of Ohio again, and that's the best example I can give you. That's where we come from. State of Ohio actually very strongly favors restrictive covenants in terms of non-competition, non-solicitation, non-disclosure, in terms of enforceability. But there are many states who are very stringent. They're not like the state of Ohio. So when you are doing a transaction and when you get an agreement, if it says the laws of Delaware will govern the agreement or the laws of Ohio or the laws of California, you would want to spend time with your legal advisors to see that at a state level, what does this mean for you, the restrictive covenant, and then at the federal level, what does that mean, you know? Because like I said, restrictive covenant enforceability is definitely at state level, you know? But however, there are certain parameters which the courts have put in terms of enforceability. If those parameters have been fulfilled, then restrictive covenants will be enforceable. So for example, they want to make sure that the protection is no greater than what is required. You know, another good example is they want to make sure it's not harmful to the public, you know. And even in some cases, if they find that restrictive covenants are not enforceable, the courts use what they call the blue pencil rule. Okay, the blue pencil rule is that they will not have the entire covenant unenforceable. They will try to come with a modified version of the covenant and enforce that. But having said that, this blue pencil rule is again enforceable and used in some states or not used in other states. So Ohio is one state where they do have the blue pencil rule, which shows the flexibility and enforceability of restrictive covenants in Ohio. There are some other states who don't have the blue pencil rule. So if a covenant is considered unenforceable, then it's completely striked out. There's no kind of modification as such. So these are some nuances you want to keep in mind when you start seeing these clauses in your contractual arrangement to see how would it impact you in case if it's considered unenforceable on both sides, then, you know, would you have some modification by the court or not, you know? So those are the two main clauses we see on any contractual arrangements, which would be very important for the Indian companies, you know? Another aspect of your agreements would be your IP. Now, when you are having, as an IT company, there is going to be some kind of intellectual property that's going to be involved. That intellectual property can be obviously in various forms, you know, or there can be federal, trademarks, copyright, trade secrets, patents, you know, domain names, and so on, you know. Again, in the U.S., intellectual property can be protected at a federal law level as well as a state law level. Trademarks is a good example. Generally, intellectual property of the trademark registrations are registered at a federal law level. But then sometimes what happens is, you know, we've seen with clients, they're not able to register their trademark at a federal law level because there may be, you know, descriptive words are not used and all. But if you know your business is only going to be selected to two or three states and it's not going to be done on a federal level there, you can even narrow down your scope of registration, and under specific state law registration, you can register your trademark. It gives you protection in that state. So state of Ohio, we have a provision which allows you to register your trademarks with the Secretary of the state, and it provides you with that protection in the state of Ohio. So that's a good example of federal law compliance and state law compliance. Then, you know, copyrights are obviously federal law compliance. So you have to only look at the federal laws if you're trying to protect your copyright. And then India, U.S. both are parties to the Berne Convention, so which provides a lot of protection under the convention to a U.S. To an Indian copyright in the U.S. And then the most important piece of IP I would like to bring to your attention in terms of protection in the U.S. is what we call trade secrets. As we know, in India, we do not have a trade secret law. Trade secrets are currently protected through confidentiality and non-disclosure agreements and our contractual protections that you have. However, in the U.S., at a state level, there are specific state laws which actually protects your trade secrets, and if there's a breach of your trade secret, it helps you to enforce that. So that's a lot of time we talk to clients that they may be having IP which cannot be protected from a statutory perspective. You know, for some reason we can't get a copyright, or for some reason the patent is not, we can't get a patent, or we can't get something. So we sometimes look at the fact that can this be protected under the State Secret Act we have of that particular state. Because, you know, there are other ways to also protect your IP beyond just the standard run-of-the-mill statutory arrangement. So it's very important in the particular state, if you do have trade secrets, to take a look at that under that specific state law, can your trade secret be protected? And if yes, when you're drafting those kind of contracts under the specific state laws, we actually then suggest to put particular clauses if it is truly a trade secret, which will then give you protection under that specific state laws also. But however, people misconstrue the concept of trade secret. The laws are very clear in their definition of what is considered trade secret. So trade secret is basically anything that the owner knows or the founder knows and nobody else knows. And if actually the half of the public knows your secret, then it's not considered trade secret. A good example we give is the Coca-Cola secret recipe. If you know or not, Coca-Cola has not done any statutory protection of their recipe. They protect their recipe under the trade secret concept. You know, another good example of your trade secret would be your customer's list, until you use it for marketing or things like that. That's different. Another good example is your manufacturing know-how, or if there's a particular services know-how, the way you develop a software, or the way you provide a particular kind of services. If it's kept, you know, within the small group and it's only used by your engineers and all, that could go off, come under the definition of trade secret. So it'll be very important to understand that can you come under the definition of trade secret, because what you may consider a trade secret may not be a trade secret, you know. Another good example is, a good example of the right trademark strategy, or the right IP strategy a company uses in the U.S. is Amazon. Amazon, when they started, they actually took a decision that they're not going to go berserk registering every trademark, brand name, or patent. And all. They decided to have a strategy of registration and deferral as and when the need came. So Amazon created a brand with the name Amazon. Then they created a logo with the name A, had a brand acquisition, did that trademark. But soon Amazon realized that their unique USP has been, or their USP has been the way people purchase goods on Amazon. So they realized that this one-click method, or what they call the I-click method, is actually what's leading to people to get on Amazon website and buy products. And then they realized that this is their USP, you know, and that's what's getting the brand Amazon value. So they actually patented a right, which the way you click on that and purchase goods is actually patented by Amazon in the U.S. So their strategy worked really well. They saw what works with the market, does it have IP value in it, and then obviously is it registrable. So that's a good example we give to clients, especially IT companies, that when you come to the U.S. market, you don't have to register everything. You don't have to get a patent on everything. You have to first see what is going to be used in that market, because as you know, IP protections are country-specific, you know, so you want to be very strategic about what you want to register there and what you don't want to register there, what will be used and so on. And the Amazon model is a good example of that, you know. This is the IP, the click thing. I think you all saw that. Now, how do you protect your intellectual property assets? I said there are obviously various ways you can protect it through statutory protection, but there's also, if you cannot get a statutory protection because of costs or there are other issues, then a good way of protecting them is limiting access. So in your contractual provisions, you know, we recommend that you have clauses which very clearly says who will have access to your IP, what's going to be done with that IP, what is going to be kept confidential, and then also have IP audit clauses. you know, especially on the software technology side of it. And then even if there's disclosure to third persons, make sure there's a requirement in your contract that, you know, the party to whom you're disclosing is going to forward that to a third person. They'll also have the same terms and conditions in terms of confidentiality and non-disclosure. So contractual, paying attention to contractual provisions will be very important in terms of protection of IP. Let's move on. This is an important piece in contracting. We come across a lot of times, especially with Indian companies, especially which are small family-owned companies, you know, there are parties who are signing off on agreements, but may not be associated with the agreement as a director or an owner, may not even have authority to sign that agreement. On the face of it, it looks pretty okay. You know, that's fine. You know, we have our party sign on it, the Indian party sign on it. When the dispute arises, a little bit of discovery is done at the time of dispute, then it's realized that the party who signed or the person who signed the agreement on behalf of the company did not have rights to do that. So we actually recommend to clients all the time that, you know, make sure that the proper party is signing the contract. And then most importantly, if you're going to enter into contracts on behalf of your global entity, you know, make sure the appropriate person is signing the contract in the appropriate capacity. You know, we don't use the word owner and shareholder and all, because then you're opening up a can of worms in terms of personal liability issues in the U.S. You know, use official titles like president, members, managers. We see enough contract where we see, you know, the name of the company and it's left blank, and when the contract comes back, somebody signs written down shareholder, you know, and then we see that could be a problem for the Indian company in the U.S. So just basic nuances like that, you know, nobody looks at the last page after it's signed. We actually tell the clients, make sure whoever's signing has the authority to sign. You have authority to back up that they have the authority to sign, and then very clearly put down their official title in the company, you know, so that there's no disputes moving forward. So that's another contract nuances that you want to keep in mind. You know, lastly, obviously, we're getting into contractual arrangements. There's always a clause on dispute resolution. What happens when things go down south? At least 8 out of 10 times you'll see clauses where they want to have litigation in the U.S. But obviously, why not? They are the big customers. They are the big, you know, 100,000 pound gorilla. You know, what are you going to fight with them about? You know, arbitration in India is never going to happen. So what happens is if you do get into litigation in the U.S., either you want to sue them or they sue you. You know, at least most of the time you would have to look at two jurisdictions, whether you come under federal jurisdiction or would your case fall under the state jurisdiction. And in many cases, you will see that you will fall under the federal jurisdiction, which is the federal courts. In a particular state, there are federal courts. If any of the issues of the dispute is under federal law, or if you're suing, if you are getting sued as a foreign national, from a different state from where the company is located, and if the damages are more than $75,000, you will get sued in the federal court. You know, so generally, basically, the federal court jurisdiction comes into place where there's diversity of citizenship, you know, or there's a federal law issue. So it will be fought in a federal court. Everything else will then be fought at a state level court, you know, but most of the disputes we see on the cross-border side, and sorry, there's a lot of cross-border litigation. We see it on the federal court side. Now, when people have to sue or get sued in the U.S., especially Indian companies, they get very shocked. And in some way, they are scared of the cost which is associated with litigation. But we need to keep in mind that litigation in the U.S. moves much faster, and I can't even emphasize the word much faster, than the litigation we are used to in India. You know, so there's always a speed into that litigation, and therefore there are costs associated with litigation there. So you will see costs associated with legal fees. There's a huge discovery cost depending upon what the issues are. Sometimes discovery costs can actually take up a big toll in terms of, you have to produce documents to the court, you have to produce documents to the other side, and we actually tell the parties that as soon as you know a dispute is going to arise, you start having a document retention plan. You know, every document as a part, which is a part of the dispute, make sure that, you know, somebody is retaining that. Because a lot of states in the U.S. have also come up with what they call the e-discovery rules. You know, anything which was exchanged through emails and things will all become a part of the discovery. And the discovery cost can sometimes be substantial. If there is an issue which requires an expert matter, subject matter, then there will be an expert witness. So there'll be cost of an expert testimony, you know. And then, you know, the thing is, if you are the losing party, then you should be open to the idea that you're going to be paying the other party's attorney's fees also. That's also pretty common in litigation in there. And then unlike what we see in India, you know, punitive and compensatory damages are a little difficult to get from the court, but there is a possibility of also getting compensatory and punitive damages awarded by the court. So as you can see, there's various levels of cost that you would have to deal with if you get sued there or you want to sue there, you know. And actually, Ralph can speak much more, where he's much more of a litigator. My background is mostly transaction. But you will see it's much speedier to get justice there in terms of litigation, even though the cost could be a little higher than what you're used to paying here in India. Again, market, the second option, like I mentioned, if you are not doing contractual arrangement, but you're looking at doing business in USA, then a lot of options are there for market entry operations. You know, Rajesh did a pretty good job of how you can structure your operation, but once you structure it, what do you plan to do in terms of your market entry operations? What kind of entity would you like to set up there? Would you like to set up a corporation, a general partnership, if it's a joint venture, a limited partnership, an LLC, or, you know, a branch, or, you know, if you're going to do sort of non-for-profit work, there's also a concept of a non-profit organization, you know. Generally, what we see, a corporation together with an LLC is the most preferred entity, preferred form of legal entity used by foreign investors. There are a couple of reasons for it. One is because the shareholders are responsible, are not responsible for the actions and responsibility of the corporation in terms of liability. So there's limited liability protection you get in a corporation. The other thing is there is the liability protection. We have a concept there of piercing the corporate veil, pretty used to, similar to the concept here in India. And that's only done if there has been a fraudulent activity at the corporation level. The other good advantage is that there are tax treaty benefits, you know, if you're a C-Corp. There are two kinds of corporations in the U.S. It's called an S-Corp or a C-Corp. As a foreign shareholder, you cannot set up an S-Corp. That's only for domestic shareholders, but you can set up a C-Corp. And, you know, we're not getting into tax structuring here, but, you know, there's advantages of having a C-Corp because then you can have the benefit of the India-U.S. tax treaty. There's still a gray line rule, and Nishibhai can speak a little bit more about it. If you have an LLC, which is like a flow through, you know, can you still have the India-US tax treaty benefit? So generally, for a lot of reasons, a C-Corp is what we see foreign investors coming into, except for if there's a joint venture and there are multiple partners. Then an LLC can be used as a corporate governance for structure. But then for tax purposes, the LLC can be taxed as a corporation. That's also possible. So again, you want to think about what kind of entity you want to set up there and look at, obviously, the tax structuring of those entities, you know. And like I said, there's a common reason for having a separate entity and not having like a branch or like an office there is obviously the limited liability protection. You want to try to protect the parent company as much as you can in terms of liability protection and have a separate entity. You know, the nuance in the U.S. is to choose the state you want to be incorporated in. Because unlike what we see in India is that if there is one federal law, which is the Companies Act, once you incorporate under the Companies Act, you're free to do business in any part of India. In the U.S., that's not the case. Incorporations are state-specific and are governed by state laws. So if you incorporate in a particular state, you're allowed to do business in that state. If you want to do business in another state, so if you incorporate in Ohio and then if you want to go do business in Delaware or Georgia or New York, you have to take your U.S. entity and qualify them to do business in that other state. So that's why it becomes very important for any Indian company to do the due diligence, what is the state they want to incorporate in. Some of the considerations we ask the clients to look into is obviously you want to see what is the annual state and local taxes. Because again, in U.S., you're taxed at three different levels. You're taxed at a federal level, then you're taxed at a state level, and then you're taxed at a city level. So if you are in the state of Ohio and you're in the city of Columbus, there'll be a city tax, then you'll pay a state tax, and then you'll pay a federal tax. So it's very important to do the analysis. In some states, state tax is eliminated, and there's only federal tax that you have to pay. So sometimes that due diligence is important. They take a look at what are the annual state and local tax requirements. How favorable is the corporate governance law? So a good example is the state of Delaware. Everybody is very well versed with Delaware because it has very sophisticated and mature corporate governance law. So as a foreign investor, you get comfort with the fact that there are enough case proceedings on foreign investment So they may want to go to Delaware. So you may want to take a look at that. And then obviously you want to see if it's fast, simple, and inexpensive. You can actually incorporate a company by yourself going online on the website of the Secretary of State, and within 2 days you can incorporate a company in the U.S. Very different from what we are used to in India. So think about the choice of the state of incorporation when you're going to the U.S. You know, I won't get into tax consideration. Rajesh went into that. But generally, the rule of thumb is that if you are going to have dividend distribution out of your U.S. company, there's a flat 30% withholding tax, provided it is reduced by the India-U.S. tax treaty. So that, going back to Rajesh's point, you want to be able to make sure that before you start putting your money in the U.S. company, how do you want to take your money out? And then if you're taking your money out under as a dividend, royalty, depending whatever category, you have to remember there's a 30% withholding tax, provided we can structure it under the India-U.S. tax treaty, that the withholding tax becomes less. You know, so you want to pay attention to investments and repatriation as to in what form you want to repatriate, and minimize your tax exposure when you're repatriating funds out of the U.S. And I want to spend some time on Ohio tax structure, but you're going to get the slide, so we'll just skip it. Ohio is just one example. But Ohio, the only thing I want to bring to your attention, Ohio, is there's no corporate income tax on the top of the federal income tax. You know, so that's been one of our key things. And there's no tax on sales of goods and services to customer outside of Ohio. So we see the state of Ohio as a big logistics and distribution center. So we have a lot of companies who come there and set up the distribution center, hold their inventory there, and where they're distributing and selling to other states or to customers out of the state, because then they see that there's no tax when it comes to sales outside the state of Ohio. So Ohio has some very favorable tax environment, and that's why we see a lot of foreign direct investment. So we have the TCS has set up a 750 R&D center in Milford, Ohio, which is about an hour and a half from Columbus. We have Gen Irrigation, who has set up their distribution center in Ohio. We have Mahindra, or what used to be Satyam Technologies, but it's Mahindra Technologies now. They have a 10-person office doing IT services and software development. So we see increasingly Indian companies looking at Ohio because it has a very favorable tax environment. And then most importantly, we've actually left some brochures here. The state of Ohio is actually hungry for foreign direct investment, and they are very desperate, I would use the word, to have more and more companies invest in Ohio. So they are actually willing to sit down with companies and talk about what incentives they can give an Indian company to set up operations in Ohio, and how can they help you to do that. So there could be tax incentives, there could be loans by the government for a company to buy equipment, or they're also giving what they call training program loans. So if you have 10 employees who need to be trained in a particular area, the state is providing the money for you to train your own employees. So they are actually going that extra mile to bring in more FDI into the state. So, and there's going to be a brochure left outside, or I think in your bags, which talks about the Columbus region and the offer that the state of Ohio is willing to put on the table for FDI purposes. You know, we'll just skip the labor and employment issue. The only thing you want to keep in mind when you start hiring the employees in the U.S., there are some very stringent mandatory labor requirements, very similar to what we are used to here in India. But, you know, the two biggest things you want to keep in mind in terms of labor law requirement is that America has a Disability Act. So if you do have an employee who becomes disabled or applies for a job, becomes disabled, you need to make sure that the company has arrangements put in place to make to accommodate that employee. You know, it's a law. You have to actually accommodate your employee's disability. That's the bottom line according to that act. The second thing you want to keep in mind is they do have what we call anti-discrimination laws. And actually, anti-discrimination laws have extraterritorial jurisdiction. So if a U.S. company has employee here in a subsidiary and has control over the subsidiary, the anti-discrimination laws that we have in the U.S. can also apply to that subsidiary if there was any discrimination. So basically, you have to hire employees, give them equal opportunity, you know, and you cannot discriminate based on sex, based on religion, ethnicity. So they're very stringent anti-discrimination laws. And actually, you will see each state has a civil rights commission. So if an employee is discriminated, it's a case is filed against the state, and then the company can be prosecuted. Sometimes it doesn't do great for the company's branding. So you have to keep in mind, you understand at least these two provisions of labor law, which is anti-discrimination law and Americans with Disability Act, because that's very unheard of in the U.S., in India. Yeah, I know India just recently passed a sexual harassment act. I don't even know after how many years. You know, and now it's become a big thing. In U.S., that's just the norm. So you better be used to that when you enter that market, and you would need to put compliance programs in place so that you don't go foul of these acts. Lastly, I want to share with you U.S. immigration cab. We always hear from IT companies when I meet them in the U.S., fine, this is great, I have a great customer, I'm sending people, but eventually, how will I send people there? What are the different categories I can send? How will I cater to a market? Because I do need my Indian managers. I do need my Indian engineers to be there. You know, our law firm doesn't practice immigration law, but we work with an alliance partner. We only play a role of advisory capacities because we do the business side of the contract. So we come in and just give the advisory capacity. But immigration is a very big issue for IT companies who are doing business there. You know, the most common kind of immigration category we see is what we call the L1A visa. This is if you have an entity in the U.S., then you can transfer your employees from India to the U.S. on an L1 visa, you know, for catering to your U.S. market business. But however, you know, you can only do that if there are certain categories fulfilled. That is, your employee must have worked with you for 1 year a year in India before it's transferred out to L1. And the employer has to show that that person, manager, has expertise. And for the specific project that the manager is coming for, the multiple number of projects running, he has the backer. So it's not that you can use the L1 visa to just transport people. There are criteria that need to be fulfilled. Actually, there were a lot of case laws which are happening currently in the U.S. TC has got back, HCL. There was actually a Department of Justice is after them because they supposedly they alleged that they used the L1 visa category to transport employees who did not fulfill the criteria. So there's actually a Department of Justice investigation going on TCS as well as on HCL of misusing this category. But let's see what comes out of that. You know, there's an E-1 treaty visa, you know, where, you know, if there's substantial trade between U.S. And another country, then a trader from that or an executive from that country can come. Generally, from India-U.S. perspective, this E-1 treaty visa we've seen doesn't work a whole lot because we haven't been able to still understand. Hopefully, things will change, establish substantial trade. You know, for example, U.K. and USA, they have been able to use an E-1 treaty or trader's visa. The next is what we call the E-2 treaty investor's visa, which is basically you come and set up a company in the U.S. If you are a 50% owner of that company from a thing and you make substantial investment to a U.S. enterprise, you can use the E-2 treaty visa to come to the U.S. But the most common form that we are seeing, or I should say the most used form of treaty visa we are seeing is what we call this EB-5 immigrant investor visa. What has happened is when Obama became the president the first time around, he realized that they need more foreign direct investment. And what is the best way to bring in foreign direct investment is that you put in an X amount of money and we promise you a green card, basically. That was the bottom line of the EB-5. What we started seeing is that EB-5 was happening, but not in areas that America wanted in. So they changed the EB-5 program and they said, okay, if you are an investor, individual investor, and if you invest about $500,000, $500,000, but you have to invest in a high unemployment or rural area. And if you do that, then we'll give you an EB-5 visa, which is like a green card, you know. Or if you're a company, you invest $1 million elsewhere. You don't have to invest in a rural or unemployment area. But if you invest $1 million and you hire 10 qualifying U.S. workers, then within the 2 years of your establishment or invest in a regional center, you get an EB-5 visa. So they actually modify the rules and they try to kind of expand so they bring more investors in. The biggest beneficiary of EB-5 investors have been which country? Do you want to take a guess?
China.
There you go. Somebody said China. But then what happened? You know, because there's a Democrat and Republican Party there, they have put a cap on the China investors on EB-5. Anyway, the EB-5 has 10,000 visas cap. Among that 10,000 cap, they put a cap as to how many Chinese investors can use that 10,000 visa. So actually, and that's kind of, you know, backward thinking, and President Obama has been trying to have an immigration reform and all that, and I don't understand politics, but, you know, Ralph understands it better than I do. You know, I don't know when that will happen, but they're making strides to bring in more investments by giving them visas. But yeah, China, unfortunately, were the biggest EB-5 investors and unfortunately now have a cap, you know, but things will change. We are hoping they do. But anyway, thank you for your time. And I believe you're going to have some time for Q&A later on. And I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Ralph.
I think I'm going
to
stay seated here.
I don't know. I think we need to put her. Oh, yeah. It came up. That's yours, right? Yeah.
All right, I'm going to talk to you about privacy. One of the things you're going to see very quickly is that while it seems like a very discrete topic, privacy restrictions, privacy controls, it's really wide open because of the sources of the law, where we may find problems. So it is. Very much wide open. Now, why would you be concerned about privacy if you are doing any kind of work where you are handling personal information for one of your customers that they may be gathering? You're going to be subject to the privacy laws. Three big issues that we see with privacy laws. Number one, we want to protect private health information. And I will actually talk about that probably throughout, but mainly at the end when I talk about HIPAA. We want to protect financial information. So if you're gathering any of that or holding that or maintaining that, you're going to see lots of restrictions. And finally, we're concerned about identity theft. Now, the sources of the law are both state and federal statutes. And the federal statutes tend to be very specific. We've got statutes that apply to financial institutions, statutes that apply to healthcare entities, things like that. The state laws tend to be more wide open. They're much more broadly drafted. They will not be restricted to certain industries for the most part. Vanita was talking a little bit about the difference between state and federal jurisdiction in the U.S. And yes, it's true you could be sued in either court, either state court or federal court. Typically, you get federal jurisdiction if it's a federal question, which means that a federal law is involved. So if it's one of the federal statutes, you're probably going to be in federal court. The federal courts also have pendant jurisdiction. So if we have a federal law that's been violated and the same conduct violates allegedly a state law, then the case will be brought in federal court and the federal court will hear both the state and federal claims. And then there are times when we have this diversity jurisdiction. And by diversity, we mean diversity of citizenship, meaning that the parties to the lawsuit are not both citizens, both sides are not citizens of the same state, that there is diversity of jurisdiction between the parties and at least $75,000 in controversy, then the case can be removed to federal court. All of that is somewhat important in the sense that if you're a defendant, you generally want to be in federal court. And the reason for that is the plaintiff will probably bring the case in state court. In most states in the United States, the state court judges are popularly elected. So there's a chance that they might be closer to the plaintiffs, if you will. The federal judges, although they're local judges, are appointed by the president for life. They don't ever have to run for election. They don't have to, more importantly, raise money for elections. So they tend to be a little more impartial, shall we say. So if you're a defendant, you will probably want to find a way to remove the case to federal court. All right. There is also common law claims. By that, I mean judge-made law. This is just, you know, evolved in the courts. The two big ones are invasion of privacy and negligence. And I'll spend most of the time when we get to that talking about negligence. All right. Just a few federal laws to kind of illustrate. Graham-Leach-Liley Act applies to financial institutions and insurance companies, also applies to sort of related companies like real estate appraisers who may be assisting in arranging mortgages. They'll be subject to this. And what we're trying to do here is protect customers' financial information. You have to institute reasonable controls. If there's been a breach, you've got to conduct an investigation. If there has been a breach, you may have to take steps to mitigate. You may, you know, any damage that may arise, and you may also have to notify customers. It's cumbersome. It is not a situation you want to be in. By the way, just as an aside here, you've got to be concerned about all of these things because, again, if you're, as the other speakers have said, if your customer is subject to any of these restrictions and any of these laws, they're going to stick an indemnification clause in your contract and hold you responsible for any problems that you cause. So just be aware. One thing you will see as we go through this, and when I get to the end, we can kind of wrap up with it, is the fact that one set of protocols, one set of procedures will probably protect you or give you some comfort with respect to all of these various laws. But let's continue on. Okay, the next federal law I want to talk about are something called the red flag rules. We really had a hard time implementing these. The law was first passed, I think, was supposed to take effect in 2009. It took a while for everyone to get in on board. They kept delaying it. It is actually a law that is enforced by several federal agencies, the big one being the Federal Trade Commission, and then also the Controller of the Currency for financial institutions. What the red flag rules are concerned about is identity theft. Okay, so you have to, let's skip that slide. You have to put in place protocols, procedures to protect against identity theft. And they call it the red flag rules because they've identified, or you're supposed to identify through your procedures, certain events that trigger a red flag, that cause you to be concerned that somebody might be engaged in identity theft. So it applies to you if you've extended credit to someone. Or, in your case, perhaps your customer's extended credit to someone. And then something happens, and you suspect that there might be an identity theft problem. Something very simple. Credit's been extended to a customer. We send a bill to the customer, and it comes back saying the customer's not at that address. Oh, okay. Well, who's at that address? Or who gave you that credit card? Or who gave you that credit information? You've now got an obligation to follow up. There may be some identity theft going on. Okay, so that's what we're looking at. It's very, at its heart, it's not a very complex concept. It's very mundane. If you got reason to suspect somebody's committed identity theft or there's a problem here, you've got to follow up. You've got to figure out what you're going to do. You've got to have that built into the procedures. It may be something as simple as, okay, it came back. You contact the customer. Customer says, oh, you know, I moved. I didn't give you my new address. Here it is. Once you've satisfied yourself that it is the customer, that this is legitimate, then you can move on. One important thing about the program is you want to periodically review it and update. Now, not everyone is maybe required to do this, but this is something you want to do just to protect yourself. Second thing that is very important to note there is that under the federal law, the program has to be approved by the board of directors, at least initially. And then it's very important that you train the staff. And that's something that's a theme throughout all of these laws, even if you're trying to protect against the common law claims. Train your staff. It does no good to have a procedure if they don't know what the procedure is. And a lot of times, I got to tell you in our experience, a lot of times the problem is caused by the staff just not paying attention. So constantly training the staff, it's not that the staff forgets, but it's like, you can remind them periodically that we've got to follow these laws, we've got these procedures. Just be aware of them. Okay, state laws. Now, we were talking earlier about the how the United States really isn't united. Well, here you are. 46 states, plus the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, and it was 46 at last count, who knows, have data breach statutes. But it's not a uniform data breach statute. It varies from state to state. Now, here is the really, really bad news. In any given situation, it is the law of the state where the consumer or customer resides that's going to apply to the situation. So what that means is, if you've got customers all over the United States, you're subject to all these state laws. And you may, in one data breach, be dealing with, say, the laws in 10 different states. Now, that can get a little ugly. So, generally, not only aren't they uniform, but they're broader in scope than the federal statutes, and they may apply to more than just computerized records. So California, it's personal information maintained in a computer database. If you skip down there, you can see Nebraska and Iowa, they include information that may not be computerized, things like fingerprints. New York has some tighter definitions. But at the same time, their definition of what constitutes a breach is sort of open-ended. They list some factors that may be considered breach in determining whether there's a breach, but there's not one tight definition of what a breach is. Massachusetts has recently enacted a law, recently I mean in the last several years, that many people see as the template, as the model for what may be coming. And you can see who it applies to. Anyone who includes the, I just arrived yesterday, so I'm a little tired. Anyone who owns the information, okay? That means you receive it, you store it, you maintain it, you process it, or otherwise have access to this personal information. It will apply to an IT company that is a subcontractor for, say, a financial institution, a healthcare entity, whoever. You have a duty to protect. Yes, sir.
The question is, so when I submit my personal information to a company, is the transmission of ownership also given?
No, you're not giving up ownership of the information. And what we're talking about here for the data breach purpose is that that company then is considered an owner of this computerized record that they are maintaining. And therefore, they've got to treat that according to the law. They have to protect the information. You are not giving away ownership of the information. And that's a very good question, because it could be misleading. But no, what we're saying really, we use the term own, but what we're really saying here is who's subject to the law. Who's possessing? And if you have this information in your system, you're subject to the Massachusetts law. Whether you're just holding it for your customer or yourself, whether you're maintaining it, whether you're transmitting it, whatever. Okay, you have a duty to protect. You've got to put protection in place. You've got to put security controls in place. And again, it is the same thing that I will keep saying throughout. You've got to train your staff. You've got to periodically revisit your policies and procedures. Are they dealing with the most current threats? Under the Massachusetts statute, personally identifiable information has to be encrypted when it's being transmitted electronically. Massachusetts right now is the only state that specifically requires that. But what happens when we get to the negligence standard, you know, the common law is kind of an evolving concept. It's judge-made law. It's case law. But they will look to these various statutes as to what becomes the standard. So under a negligence theory, if you don't take
proper care of the information, then you're negligent. Well, what's proper care? Well, Massachusetts has already said proper care is encrypting it when you transmit it. So it becomes part of a negligence standard, if you will. All right. Just some pointers for a minimum compliance program to protect you under the various statutes. And I would say this just goes across the board, even to the negligence standard that we may talk about here in a second. First of all, you ought to have designated people only having access to the system, accessing the information. I would also suggest that you appoint a security officer or an information officer who will be in charge of protecting the information, making sure everything is being properly handled only by the people who should handle it. The second thing is this idea of assessing the risk. And that's something that we'll see. It's kind of a repeated thing. You know, there's a tendency, if you will, for people to use a one-size-fits-all privacy program or data protection program. You know, it's some other companies used it. Maybe your chief information officer or security officer brought it over from their previous employer. Well, okay, that's well and good as a starting point. But you have to assess what are the risks that your company faces with respect to this information, and what do you need to do to protect against those risks. And we'll see, you know, I will tell you under HIPAA, which we'll cover here in a few minutes, one of the biggest areas, one of the biggest failures by companies is the failure to assess the risk and design the data protection program to address those specific risks. The other thing is, in addition to training employees, you've got to discipline them when they violate the procedures. It does no good to have them either not know what the procedures are or not do something about it if, in fact, they've violated them. You need to immediately cut off access to the information when an employee's employment is terminated, whether voluntarily or involuntarily. You know, you can't wait a week, if you will. You've got to oversee all the service providers and subcontractors. If you've got somebody coming in performing a maintenance function on your system, make sure that they're going to recognize that they can't freely access and use the information. You want to monitor who's having access, what's happening with the information. All right. Again, some minimum standards for the system itself. I won't drag you through all of those, but you can see, again, this is pretty much common sense kind of things. But you need to look at these things, see which ones fit for you. Okay, the negligence theory. All right. Negligence is the failure to take due care. And obviously, if we have a data breach, the plaintiff is going to claim you were negligent. You didn't take care of the information. That has been a regular cause of action. It has not, until recently, been very successful. And that's because one of the other elements of a negligence claim is you have to show that because someone didn't take due care of this information, you were harmed. Okay. A lot of times there's a data breach, but nobody knows what happened to the data. There's no evidence that anyone's misused it. There's no evidence that somebody's credit has been hurt or somebody's identity's been stolen. So without that, do we have any harm? And so courts were routinely dismissing the negligence cases because it was difficult to show that there was damage, and the damage was speculative. This may be changing. In fact, I'm pretty sure it is changing. And so one of the things you've got to keep in mind is that it can be very fact-intensive.
the Walgreens case that I have up here, they were hit with a $1.4 million verdict because they had a pharmacist employee who her husband had had an affair with another woman prior to them getting married. And the other woman had become pregnant. And the husband, former boyfriend of the other woman, had suspected that she had decided to go off birth control. He felt like he had been trapped. Turns out that the ex-girlfriend was a patient at the pharmacy where the now wife was a pharmacist. So the wife checks the prescription records. And lo and behold, the woman wasn't having any birth control pills dispensed. And so she told her husband. Her husband confronted the ex-girlfriend. The ex-girlfriend sued the pharmacy, Walgreens, and recovered a $1.4 million judgment, which was upheld by the Court of Appeals. Now, very fact-intensive, you know, the intentional conduct there was probably a big factor. You know, this just wasn't somebody made a mistake and sent the information to the wrong place. This was clearly, you know, offensive conduct. So that really probably helped drive this decision. But again, it's changing. Some courts have latched on to this idea of consumer protection laws as a way to keep the case in court. Some plaintiffs have amended their complaint to say not only was the defendant negligent, but the defendant violated the consumer protection laws. Because when the plaintiff signed up for whatever it was they signed up for, and in this case it was the Sony PlayStation, when they signed up, there was all kinds of language in there that Sony was going to protect their information. Sometimes you even pay extra to get enhanced protection. And now there's been a breach. Well, Sony misrepresented that they would protect the information. They lied to the consumer in order to induce the consumer to subscribe.
Okay.
That's a violation of the consumer protection laws. At least in this case, it was consumer protection laws in Florida and Michigan. And almost all consumer protection laws don't require showing actual damage. There are statutory damages.
This was a class action suit?
They started off as a class action suit. What happens is it gets narrowed because at the end of the day, only the consumers in Florida and Michigan are left in the class. But still a problem for Sony. And by the way, any of these things, I mean, it's just not talk about bad news for branding. Saying that you can't protect the data is bad news. All right. Let's talk about HIPAA. HIPAA is the Health Insurance Portability and Affordability Act, and it includes protection of personal health information. It's a federal statute. It does not include a private cause of action. It is enforced by an agency called the Office of Civil Rights at Health and Human Services, and it is also enforced by the state's attorney general. However, much of HIPAA is starting to bleed over into the negligence standard. So even though there's no private cause of action for violating this specific federal statute, violating the federal statute could give rise to a negligence claim. In fact, that was one of the things that was discussed in the Walgreens case. Now, who does HIPAA apply to? Well, HIPAA applies to covered entities. Covered entities are essentially healthcare providers, doctor's offices, hospitals, pharmacies, clinics. Not anybody here, I don't think. But you may well be business associates. And I don't know why that S got left on the end there, but it looks kind of neat. At any rate, business associates are subcontractors to covered entities. So if you're providing support services to a healthcare provider, you're going to be subject to HIPAA. So here are the healthcare covered entities, a health plan, a healthcare clearinghouse,
and a healthcare provider who transmits information electronically. The protected health information is any individually identifiable health information. Now, somebody might say, well, you know, we're just a data aggregation service. We're providing a service to this big hospital to kind of sort out, you know, what kind of cases they have, you know, what kind of results they're getting. And so we're not using the people's names. We're just kind of sorting the information. We're using, you know, anonymous identifiers. I can tell you that the HIPAA rules have a long list of what is required if you're going to treat the information as de-identified. You can't have name, you can't have social security number, you can't have any other identifying number, you can't use the zip code unless you have at least 2,000 pieces of information in the database. It just goes on from there. There can't be anything in there that would link back to an individual. So it takes a lot to de-identify the information. All right. Business associate. Look at how this language kind of comes through everywhere here. Very similar to the Massachusetts statute. Anyone who creates, receives, maintains, or transmits protected health information on behalf of a covered entity. So if you're helping a hospital process claims, if you're a data aggregation service, these are the kinds of people who would be business associates. Here are some examples. Okay. Statute specifically provides who is not a business associate. You know, the healthcare provider themselves is not a business associate. Healthcare providers who are jointly treating a patient are not business associates. So the doctor is not a business associate of the hospital. The hospital is not a business associate of the pharmacy. Why? Because they're all subject to the law as covered entities. So they're not business associates. One thing I will tell you is law firms are business associates if they are receiving health information in the course of representing healthcare providers. Our law firm has HIPAA policies in place. We have been a business associate. In the course of my practice, I've represented doctors who are caught up in investigations, including criminal investigations for Medicaid and Medicare fraud. It requires that we look at individual patient files, review those claims, see if they were proper. In order for me to look at that patient information that is being produced for the government, we have to sign a business associate agreement. We have to protect that information just like the covered entity. That means any IT company handling protected health information is probably going to be a business associate. Okay, who's not a business associate? Very limited types of entities, employees. If you've got a cleaning company, that was one that came up early on and was sorted out in the rules. You know, obviously, if the janitor's coming in every night cleaning up the office, the janitor could access, I suppose, health records, but they're not subject to HIPAA. They're not a business associate. We also have, in addition to what we call the privacy rules, there are security rules in HIPAA. These establish just very basic, hardcore kind of protections, technical, physical, and administrative safeguards. They're really, you know, you just have to look at them and make sure you comply. Administrative safeguards, you know, again, just having the training, having the protocols, having procedures to deal with emergencies, having procedures to deal with breaches. Physical safeguards, you know, keeping the information locked up, giving access only to people who need to access the information. Technical safeguards, again, transmission security is a big one here.
I always tell healthcare providers that if you're going to send patient information electronically, it needs to be encrypted. Now, there is a procedure by which the patient can say, you don't need to bother to encrypt it, but you want to make sure that you've got that well documented. You may hear of something called the Omnibus Rule. The Omnibus Rule took effect in September of 2013. This is essentially a revision of the HIPAA rules that made a few changes. And one of the big changes that it made from your point of view is business associates are now directly answerable to the federal government. It used to be that business associates only owed an obligation to whoever the covered entity was that they were doing business with. Now they're subject to the federal law and the federal government themselves. Just some of the other restrictions contained in the Omnibus Rule. You can see up there there's research uses of protected health information. This is where we get into the de-identification. Okay, we can de-identify the information, use it to look at statistics for healthcare research. But again, look very carefully at what's required to de-identify the information. The rules provide model business associate agreements. Essentially, the business associate has to agree to comply with HIPAA. If you violate HIPAA or if there's a data breach, you may have to notify, well, you do have to notify the individuals involved. If it's a large-scale data breach, more than 500 people involved, there's got to be public notification. You also have to notify the federal government that you breached. Then they're probably going to come in and poke around, and then they're going to see that you didn't do a good risk assessment, and you didn't train your employees, and so they're going to fine you maybe several million dollars. And it's happened. I think I'll just go right through this. This is sort of the wrap-up, if you will, for all of this. The one thing missing here is the risk assessment. But once you do the risk assessment, you put policies and procedures in place, you train the employees, you document the employee training, and documentation is key. You hold regular training. It's not enough to train them initially. You got to have regular in-services, maybe once a year. You discipline employees who fail to follow the procedures. If a breach occurs, you take steps to notify the individuals involved and to mitigate. Mitigate may require, if we're going back, say, to the financial data, mitigation may be that you arrange at your expense to pay for some sort of subscription to a service that will monitor the consumer's credit to see if anyone is abusing their credit card or has stolen their identity. And that's a very good thing to do, because in mitigating the damages, you will minimize your exposure. I've gone a little long, and I'm sorry, but that's right. Yes.
Being a practitioner in information security, I often get asked this question. Companies can do all the right things. They can get the right people engaged as well, right? But breach happens, right?
Breaches happen.
2 days back, the central U.S. command got hacked, right?
Yes.
The military institution got hacked, right?
Yes.
Twitter account got hacked.
Yeah. Now, the company can do certain things, right? But in case such a breach happens, what's the countermeasure that they take? I mean, there would be financial damages, there would be reputation damages.
Yes.
There are certain companies which offer cyber insurance, but there is a very limited cap. So what can be done? I mean, I'm looking at it from the other side, right?
Okay, what can be done? The most you can do is to put yourself in a position to say, we did everything we possibly could. Okay? So we did the assessment, we did the procedures, we were monitoring all along. You know, where we saw that we had exposure and problems, we made changes.
That's an evidence that you need to present.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting that you mentioned insurance. One of the things, there is data breach insurance, as you said. one of the things that we've sometimes seen in, for example, business associate agreements is the covered entity requires that the business associate have data breach insurance. We have typically, if we're representing the business associate, taken the position that we're striking that clause. Whether we have, as a business associate, the data breach insurance or not is a business decision for the business associate to make. All the covered entity should be really asking for is that the business associate indemnify the covered entity. Now, sometimes we're successful, sometimes we're not.
Some of the companies, apart from following the HIPAA standards, they are also going for the SOX compliance. So, any similarity between this? Because I think the HIPAA is also part of the SOX compliance, right?
Yeah, there is a great deal of similarity in the sense, you know, going back to my point, if you're handling different kinds of information or you're guarding against, you know, exposure under all these various laws, I think, really, the same common sense sort of protocols apply across the board. And if you go with the most restrictive, and HIPAA would probably be one of the most restrictive, you know, you start putting those sorts of protections in place, you're doing a lot of what you, probably all that you can do. But again, I can't emphasize enough, you've got to stay on top of it. It's not something that you say, okay, we got HIPAA called in. And believe me, I know, because I know how my clients are. You know, you give them the policies and procedures, you work with them to develop them, and they say, yep. There's the policies and procedures. See that binder up there on the shelf? There it is. Has anyone looked at it in the last 9 months? No. Have the employees been trained? Maybe. Has anyone reminded the employees? Because as you say, it happens. And when it happens, it's some stupid mistake by an employee who may well be making no more than minimum wage. And how do you guard against that? You just keep trying to drive it home. But, you know, it happens. People send the information, you know, you send out a patient record to the wrong patient. Well, that's no good. But it happens.
Good evening. I am aware of the time, and I am going to respect time. So, what we discuss in this part of the discussion basically is sort of a reverse situation where U.S. companies or any other non-Indian companies use India as a base for outsourcing or for processing. And we look at the Indian data protection law that you need to be aware about in that situation. And the discussion will be in two parts. First, we'll look at the applicable law, and then we'll discuss some typical scenarios and that we've seen clients face when they use India as a processing hub, and we'll see how the Indian law applies in those scenarios. Okay, right. So first of all, what really is the Indian law relating to data protection? India doesn't have a specific privacy law or a specific data protection law. Privacy is protected as a constitutional remedy under Article 21, but that's mostly available as against state action. For data protection also, we don't have a specific legislation for data protection. What we have is the 2011 rules, which were introduced under the Information Technology Act of 2000. And the Information Technology Act is basically the overarching legislation that governs e-commerce and cybersecurity. And they decided to plug in the data protection legislation as a rule to the IT Act. It's a very small rule. It's about 4 or 5 pages, but it keeps us busy. So the data protection rule in India applies to a very limited set of information, which you can see on the slide up there. Interestingly, it doesn't cover some sorts of information which are typically covered in other data protection legislation, such as ethnicity, racial background, etc. And also, it applies to information in the electronic form. So it doesn't apply to information which is in physical form because it's under the IT Act. When does the data protection law apply in India? the law generally applies when there is a nexus to India as a territory. So if the activity of collection takes place in India, or if any processing activity is taking place in India, or if storage is taking place in India, or if India is used to transfer data into India or out of India, that's when the Indian data protection law applies. So in the outsourcing situation, collection may not take place in India, but you definitely have storage and processing happening, and that's when the law applies. There are various compliances which Indian law prescribes for entities collecting and processing data in India. And what we'll do is we'll quickly go through some of the important compliances, and we'll see how the compliances either apply or do not apply to specific processing activities. The first compliance is consent. Indian law says that consent needs to be obtained from the data subject at the point when data is being collected. So in a situation where we have a U.S. company that's collecting information in the U.S. and then sending that information to India to a BPOC for processing, in that case, the activity of collection is happening outside of India. So first, the IT Act would not really apply to the activity of collection. Secondly, the U.S. company is anyways not subject to Indian law. To the IT Act. Thirdly, after the data protection rules were introduced, the government issued a clarification a few months later, which basically said that for entities which are processing entities, which are doing services of collection or processing in India for other entities as a service provider, they would be exempt from some compliances. So specifically, they would be exempt from the compliance of taking consent. So the Indian entity, when it's only doing processing, does not need to bother about consent. Consent may be relevant for the U.S. entity when it's collecting data from a U.S. law perspective, but that's not really relevant for the Indian processor. The second compliance is privacy policy. Privacy policy is mandatory for both collectors and processors, and it needs to be available in electronic form on the website of any company that's dealing with sensitive information in India. And it basically needs to have a clear statement of how the company is dealing with sensitive information, what sort of information it's collecting, how it's processing, how it's protecting that information. The third important compliance is transfer restrictions. So Indian law basically says that when any entity is collecting sensitive information and transfers that information to any third party within India or outside of India, there are a few things that it needs to do. A, it needs to obtain consent of the data subject, or it needs to ensure that there is some sort of documentation in place which necessitates the transfer of the data. And two, it needs to ensure that the transferee complies with at least the same level of data protection which the transferor complies to under Indian law. Now, when we look at transfer restrictions in the scenario of data processing in India, what would usually happen is that the data would be collected outside of India and brought into India for processing. Now, when it's collected outside of India by a non-Indian entity, these transfer restrictions do not apply for the leg of transfer from the U.S. into India. However, if the Indian entity is going to further sort of transfer for any reason, then it could apply. The fourth important compliance are the reasonable security measures which any entity dealing with data in India needs to comply with. And this is mandatory for both collectors as well as processors. So there's no exemption to not have security measures in place simply because you're a processing unit. And the way they define security measures is, the law says that security measures may be contractually agreed, or you may implement security measures which the government has recognized. Today, the government has only recognized this particular ISO standard as one of the recognized methods. So unless a company is ISO certified, essentially it's the internal policies of the company, essentially it's the contracts which a company enters into which will determine the company's security policies. And it's really important for anybody dealing with data, whether as a collector, as a processor, as a storage unit, etc., to actually have a good documented policy regarding how you're protecting information. And this need not always be technical solutions. You know, we've seen a lot of policies which are administrative in nature, which are managerial in nature. Basically, For example, you could have a policy that says that, you know, employees who are dealing with sensitive information of customers, of vendors, etc., need to update their passwords every 2 days. It could have a policy that says that if you take printouts of electronic information, how do you need to deal with those printouts? Do you need to shred them? Do you need to lock them up? You know, things like that. So it's what's important is that you need to have a policy in place, and more importantly, you implement the policy. You know, Ralph spoke very eloquently about the need for training and the need for constant training. And, you know, we can't emphasize that enough. It's important to educate the stakeholders in the company about the security policies. Now, we quickly discuss a few scenarios where India is being used as a data processing hub, and we'll see how the Indian law really applies. The first scenario is we have a bank in the U.S. which collects information from its customers anywhere in the world. This bank has a services agreement with a BPO in India, under which it's transferring data to India for processing. Now, and this we're looking at from a purely Indian law perspective. There may be local laws in the U.S. or elsewhere which need to be complied with in any case. So under Indian law, would consent be required? Again, because it's a processing unit, it's anyways exempt as per the clarification which the government had issued. So for the transfer of data from U.S. into India, Indian law would not require consent. Would anyone need to have a privacy policy in place? Yes, the Indian processor would need to have a privacy policy in place. Would any transfer restrictions need to be complied with? Since the transfer is happening, since collection is happening outside of India and it's getting transferred into India by a U.S. entity, there is no transfer restriction which the U.S. entity would need to comply with under Indian law. If the Indian entity is further going to do any transfer, then it would apply. Security measures. Yes, it's the Indian entity that needs to implement and maintain a proper security policy. Now, just a derivative of this scenario, if this Indian BPO is not just a processing unit, but is actually undertaking collection as well. So under its services agreement, if it also is allowed to sort of call up customers or email customers and take information from them, then in that case, would consent apply? Now, here, because the BPO is basically acting as a service provider, even though the collection is happening by an entity in India, the BPO would be exempt from taking consent because of the clarification that was issued. So any entity that's providing a service of collection or storage or of processing need not comply with certain compliances under the law, and obtaining consent is one of them. Moving on to another scenario, this is something that we see very often with organizations that have regional offices all over the world. Take a scenario where we have an organization with an office in the US, an office in Europe, and an office in India. Now, each of these regional offices is collecting employee data at a local level. And they may transfer all of that employee data to the affiliate in India for any reason. You know, we've seen because they want to consolidate records, because they want to consolidate some payroll function or any other function. So they're transferring all of the locally collected data into India for processing. In this situation, let's see what are the compliances that are required in India. Firstly, consent. Under Indian law, when the Indian entity is collecting the data from its employees in India, it would need to take consent because it's an Indian entity collecting in India. But when it's receiving information of employees outside of India, and this information is being sent by a US company and a European company, then they do not require consent from the data subjects in those jurisdictions. Privacy policy, yes, the Indian entity would need a privacy policy even though it's just a processor. Transfer restrictions. Again, like we discussed in the first scenario, because the transfer is happening from U.S. into India or from Europe into India, Indian law would not require consent for that transfer. But if the Indian company is going to further transfer, then yes, it would require consent. It would require the Indian company to ensure that the transferee has at least a minimum level of data security. Security measures, again, need to be implemented by the Indian company in India. Now again, the third scenario is a slight variation, where the Indian company is doing the actual job of collecting the information. So say there is a portal that is maintained by the Indian company where employees from all over the world can enter their data. Or they're doing it through any other means, you know, through emails or through phone calls. But basically, it's the job of the Indian entity to do the collection. And they're also processing all of that data in India. So in that case, even though it's collecting data from all over the world, the collection is happening in India. So they would require consent under Indian law. They would require the privacy policy to be in place. They would require to adhere to transfer restrictions, and they would also require the security measures to be in place. The last scenario we're dealing with is, say there is a company in the U.S., which is basically a hotel, and it has a sort of a group hotel in India. And the website of that hotel is maintained by the U.S. company. So when people try to book rooms or do any reservations on the website, the data is essentially being controlled by the U.S. entity. Now, they send the data over to India under a services agreement for processing, not for anything else, but for processing. Now, in this case, you know, the situation would be similar. Data is being collected outside of India, being sent into India for processing. So consent would not be required when you're transferring the data. Privacy policy would be required to be maintained by the hotel in India. And the transfer restrictions would not apply because, again, it's coming from outside of India into India. Security measures would be needed to be implemented by the Indian company. Now, just take a small derivative of this. If the U.S. entity is there is some sort of a contract between the U.S. entity and the Indian entity, under which the U.S. entity is acting as an agent of the Indian entity in doing the collection. Now, in that case, even though the website is maintained by the U.S. entity, it is acting in its capacity as an agent when it's collecting the information. So does it need to obtain consent under Indian law? But the law is not clear in this respect. However, because there is an agency relationship in place, it's very likely that consent requirements would need to be maintained because you have an agency relationship in place, and the U.S. entity is then acting as the Indian entity when it's collecting the information. This is my last slide. When we're, you know, Ralph spoke a lot about data breaches and, you know, the steps you need to take when there is a data breach under U.S. laws. In India, we don't have a regulatory authority till now for data protection or for privacy. And Indian law today does not have breach notification requirements as such. Unless any foreign law has any extraterritorial application on an Indian company, there's no such law that requires breach notification. However, we've seen that in outsourcing situations, when there is a contract, when there is an outsourcing contract in place, foreign companies impose very stringent, very stringent compliances on Indian processes, which require them to sort of monitor any breach, report any breach, and take a lot of action if there is any breach. So most of it is contractual. It's not under any law, but there are a lot of contractual limitations which can be placed. The legal penalty which is really imposed is triggered when there is negligence in maintaining security measures to protect information, and the negligence causes wrongful loss or wrongful gain to any person. Now, in that case, the law says that compensation will be given to the affected person. It's unquantified, so it depends on, you know, how much loss has been suffered. But the key point is that there has to be negligence, which would assume that there is some duty of care, which would assume that there has been some tangible loss caused to some person. And there is no provision as such which says that if there is no loss, or if you've not proven negligence, you've just not complied. See, you don't have a proper privacy policy in place. Are you going to be penalized under the law? There is no specific provision, but the IT Act does have a residuary penalty provision which says that if you've not complied with any provision of the IT Act and there is no specific penalty provided, then there is a small penalty of, I think, 25,000 rupees, which is prescribed. So the penalties may not be much, but the compliance standards are high. I think that's all I have. I think we'll open for questions.
What form of consent is required? Can it just be like a blanket consent when, you know, let's say, a hotel guest is signing in, they consent to the transmission of the information?
Right. So the consent, that, first of all, it needs to be in writing, which can also be electronic means, but it needs to be in writing. And when consent is being taken, basically the data subject needs to know what data is going, to whom it's going, whether it's going to be transferred, whether there's an agency that's collecting on behalf of another agency. So these are the main things that, that you need to ensure in the consent.
Can the consent be revoked at any point?
Yes. So the law basically says that you can withdraw consent or you can refuse to give consent. And what happens when you withdraw consent or refuse to give consent is that the person asking for consent can refuse to provide the goods or services for which you need consent. This may not work in all situations, like in an employment situation. If you don't give consent, there's no goods or services really in place. So it's not clear whether it would be considered a misconduct or whether you can take some disciplinary action against the employee not giving consent, but that's what the law really says now.
Yeah. Now, let's do one thing, if you don't mind. I think there could be a lot of people on the phone, and that it would be more inconvenient for them to wait on the phone. Maybe some of them might have dropped out, but if you can take some questions online, if there are any. If not, then we'll quickly go to. So can we just check if we can take anybody from the phone?
Thank you very much. Participants, we will now begin with the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and 1 on the touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and 2. Participants are requested to use only handsets while asking a question. We have the first question from the line of Arvind Pardesi from Reliance Industries. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you everyone for the sharing of the knowledge. My doubt is that suppose, for example, there is an agreement between two companies, a company ABC from India and company XYZ from USA. Now what has happened, there is a mutual clause regarding the corruption and bribery, wherein the fact is that, assume that the Indian company have bribed the US company. Now, is there any bad or wrong consequences which I will have to meet up or face under the advanced laws? I mean, beside the Indian Penal Code.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is Vinita Mehra from Kegler Brown. That's a very good question, and actually I should have clarified in my presentation. The Foreign Corrupt Practice Act comes into place when you're bribing government officers.
Correct.
So that's the most important distinction.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is corruption happening between two private entities, obviously you won't be under the FCPA, but however, you are violating the Code of Conduct. And then based upon corruption activities, there could be civil cases and so on. But the FCPA purely applies when there's corruption activities happening with foreign officials. And the definition of foreign officials are basically government officers, be it in the U.S. or be it in India or be it in China. So that's actually the distinction. So I guess you had a very good question, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to clarify that doubt, that it would apply in this context of foreign officials or government officials only.
Yeah. Nishit here, just to...
Yes, Nishit, please.
Yeah. Okay. Beyond FCPA, now other countries have introduced bribery acts, right? The UK.
Right.
And my understanding is that even covers power, private... corruption act. So you just get to understand that this situation could also arise. And I don't know if U.S. would change law at some point in time, But at the moment, at least, it covers only governmental officials.
Right. See, Nishit, my question is that, see, you know, I know that we are doing something unethical and something wrong. But just because...
We are not doing unethical. We are only advising.
No. I'm...
Okay.
I'm saying that under
I appreciate
sorry
the
under
government
that
will,
agreement,
I will be
sorry.
Delighted to discuss this point
right. Under that agreement you know that and I also know that yes there is something unethical and something legally wrong act has been committed and you and I are fully in knowledge. But the issue is that, yes, you know that UK Bribery Act has the jurisdiction limit, the FCPA has the jurisdiction limit, but the governing law provisions of the main agreement says the laws of the India. Then in that case, I think, yes, it is not easy to comment upon that, yes, this provision will apply or that provision apply, right?
These are extraterritorial provisions
correct.
As well, by the way. It's not just confined. So, you know, this is a little tricky, but maybe if Vinita wants to spend 30 seconds...
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who want to ask questions,
right.
But and we'll be delighted to discuss in more detail. But
Vinita. So as Nishit Bhai said, your agreement can be governed by laws of India. But however, the clause which you have on compliance with laws, we make sure then the definition we put in that FCPA. So even if it's laws of India, you have not complied with FCPA. We try to tie that to the indemnification clause. So if your U.S. customer, U.S. service provider, or U.S. partner gets affected due to your non-compliance of anti-corruption law, then we try, and if the U.S. company has suffered damages because of that or they were penalized by the Department of Justice in the U.S., the tie-up is actually through indemnification. Now, the question arises, where will you enforce this clause? Then that gets tied up to your dispute resolution clause. So there are multiple layers that you have to look at. You know, you can't look at FCPA in isolation or compliance with law in isolation. You have to look at it, what will happen when you want to enforce it.
Okay.
What do you have remedies in terms of recovering damages through indemnification or what? And you have to look at the whole agreement as a whole. So you can just not say, oh, I have Indian law governing, so what are you going to do with me about FCPA? That's the same argument that I said early on. Gauri and I face this all the time because the Indian company is like, yeah, who cares about FCPA? I'm in India, Indian law, who's coming after me? But you have to look at the agreement as a whole, that what can be the repercussions of it if you don't comply with the compliance with law.
Yes.
But yeah, we'll be happy to discuss with you all at a later time, but don't look at it in an isolated manner.
Right. Thanks.
Any other person on the phone? We can relieve them first. Just please bear with us for a couple of minutes.
There's no participant in the queue as of now.
Okay. So we can go on. Please tell your name and question.
Yeah, I am Sunit. So I had this question about the rules that you talked of under the IT Act. First of all, when you say they are only rules, they don't have the provision of law per se. They are just a statute which has been created under the law. When they don't have any penalty or remedies, it is basically a toothless law. Don't you think so? It is just a feel-good law to ensure that we get the BPO business and the other countries think that we are compliant when we are not actually being compliant in terms of remedies at least.
Okay. The rules do have the force of law because it's enacted as a part of the IT Act. It's enacted under one of the provisions of the IT Act. So they do have the force of law. And it's not just a feel-good factor. It may not be adequate or adequate. That's a separate argument. But they do have the force of law. And there are penalties which are triggered when there is negligence in implementing the security standards. But like I mentioned, there is no specific penalty for non-compliance, which is not very unusual. Even Ralph had mentioned that most of the action is taken when you've been negligent and not just because you forgot to do something. When there's actual negligence, which means there's been a serious lack of processes in the company, that's when the penalties will trigger. But yes, one, they do have the force of law, and second, there are some penalties.
I think just to add to that, one is the civil sort of remedy that Rocky mentioned. There is another provision under the IT Act which is more of a criminal nature, but that is there. It is more of, intentional disclosure.
When there is intentional disclosure of confidential information or personal information that has been shared with an organization and such intentional disclosure that is, you know, equivalent, you know, as you may understand, you know, under the criminal law, that intentional disclosure will be considered to be an offense, and then there are criminal sanctions also in that case. But that is in case of, you know, very rare situations.
When there's breach of contract.
Yeah, in case of a breach of contract.
I'll probably extend. I mean, you know, in Maharashtra itself, there have been cases, divorce cases, where IT Act provisions have been used, wherein, you know, exchange of confidential information was done. There are rulings as well. Electronic information was disclosed to somebody which was material to the case, and there was a financial penalty done. There are rulings now. I mean, it exists of this law.
Okay, thanks.
Is there
anyone else on the call
with a question? Okay, thank you. Timed it well. Okay, thank you. First of all, Vinita and Ralph, you know, for coming all the way and, you know, educating the audience here and on the phone. Thanks to NASSCOM. NASSCOM has always been, you know, supportive of any initiatives that we have been taking. So just one email from us and they are, you know, all there to support us. And, you know, the other, you know, I mean, what we are planning with NASSCOM is, in fact, an annual sort of event calendar, and you know, you will shortly receive, probably once we finalize that, the next one probably being on after the budget on the tax issues affecting, you know, the IT industry, because that's something we really need to understand, especially with various tax regime, you know, changing. Rajesh may be able to add more, you know, once we have the budget. So that's the next one on the calendar. And thanks Rajesh, thanks Rathi, you know, for contributing on the India side. Thanks for the wonderful audience. I think your questions have been very relevant, and I was watching that, you know, some of you were taking notes. So I hope this event has been helpful for you. And most importantly, we look forward to receiving any feedback that you may have. So it will help us to, you know, better plan for the next events as well. Okay, thank you. If you have any further questions, you know, we'll definitely be happy to discuss it while we, you know, informally talk after this particular event. Thank you very much and have a good evening.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Ladies and gentlemen, with this we conclude today's conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your line.